Let's turn to the book of Ezra. The book of Ezra is the first of what is known as the post-captivity books. It deals with an extremely important part of the history of the nation of Israel. Their release from their captivity. Now, the nation of Israel, the northern kingdom, were taken captive by the Assyrians. And it was the practice of the Assyrians to move the people out of their native surroundings and to repopulate them in other areas to totally break down their morale and their sense of national identity and the feeling of this ethnic feeling of ethnic group and its synity, ethnic synity. But then later, Judah, the southern kingdom, was taken captive and carried off to Babylon. So the land that God had promised his people was lying desolate or had been repopulated by other ethnic groups. When the Assyrians attempted to repopulate the northern kingdom of Israel, they had difficulty, for the wild animals began to attack the people, the villages. So they complained to the Assyrian king, and the people had said, "We don't know the customs of these people's gods. And so send some of the people to teach us the custom of their gods in order that we might worship him and stave off the attacks of these wild animals." And so some of the Israelites were brought back to teach the people who had been repopulated in the northern kingdom the worship of Jehovah. Now, these people married, intermarried, became mixed, and were known as the Samaritans. And they inhabited the area that was generally the area that belonged to Israel, the northern kingdom. Whereas the area of Judah remained pretty much desolate after the Babylonian captivity, the time has come for the word of God to be fulfilled, and thus we read in Ezra chapter 1. Now, in the first year of Cyrus, which would have been the year 536, 538 BC, there's differences of opinions from the commentators. The first year, and that would be the first year of Cyrus's reign after the conquering of Babylon. Cyrus actually began his reign in about 552 BC. And so this would be the first year of the reign of Cyrus after the conquering of Babylon. That the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, and he made a proclamation throughout all of his kingdom and put it in writing. Jeremiah had predicted in Jeremiah 25:11 and in 29:10, he had predicted that they were going to be taken captive by Babylon, and he predicted that the period of captivity would be 70 years. Now, as you read the book of Daniel chapter 9, which took place just before this, In about 538 BC, chapter 9 of the book of Daniel, Daniel began to fast and pray and seek the Lord, having read, it says, the prophecy of Jeremiah, or realizing from the prophecies of Jeremiah that the 70 years of captivity were almost over. Daniel, who was, of course, high in the court of the Persian king, began to fast and pray and seek the Lord, making himself available to God should God have in mind using Daniel in some way for the repatriation of the people. And so he was just making himself available, and of course it was during this time of his fasting and prayer that the angel Gabriel came to him, and interestingly enough, did not give him any instructions at all as far as the place or the role that he might play in the repatriation, but did give him fantastic prophecies concerning the times that God appointed for the nation of Israel, the city of Jerusalem, and the coming of their Messiah, giving to Daniel the very year that the Messiah would be appearing. But it is interesting to me that Daniel was a prophecy buff. He had been reading the prophecies of Jeremiah. He was interested in them. And he was sort of governing his life according to the prophecies. And I think that that is an important thing. That we have enough sense to let our lives be guided by the prophecies. In this light, now I don't mean to be a financial counselor at all, but for you who have invested in gold and silver as a hedge against inflation and all, you should read James, who says, go to now, ye rich, weep and howl for the woes that have come upon you. For you have set up, you know, you've bought up the gold and silver as a hedge in the last days, but, you know, it's going to be worthless. It's going to be cankered and all, and you're going to lose your investment. So, on the other hand, if you read the book of Revelation, you'll find that a quart of wheat is going to be selling for $50. So you might take some commodities on wheat and corn for... if you want to be the richest man in the tribulation, just... you notice what's happening in the Midwest right now? Corn Belt, the wheat and so forth, tremendous drought, the Mississippi and the Ohio rivers don't have enough water that they can get the barges down right now, and they felt that they were conquering this vast surplus of grains that we'd had. We've been trying to get rid of the grain and balance things out, and this was the year that they felt, well, they're going to bring it in balance. Well, unless something dramatic happens, it's going to be the other way around. We're going to have a shortage. So something to watch, because the Bible does speak about the shortage of the grains in the last days. But Daniel, a prophecy buff, had been reading Jeremiah and no doubt had been reading Isaiah also. Because according to Josephus, book 2, chapter 9, something like that. Josephus of Judea, he writes that Daniel brought to Cyrus the prophecies of Isaiah and showed to him where he had been named in the prophecies of Isaiah. Now, back in Leviticus chapter 24, God gave the law of the Sabbaths of the land. When you come in the land that the Lord thy God shall give to thee, then you're to plant the land for 6 years. And in the seventh year, you're not to plow it, you're not to plant it, you're to give the land rest, that the land might have its Sabbath. Every seventh year is Sabbath for the land. In the 25th chapter of Leviticus, there is a prophecy concerning that they would not obey that commandment. And therefore the Lord will drive you out of the land in order that he might give the land its Sabbaths. The kingdom of Israel under Saul to the time of Zedekiah and the taking of the Judah into captivity was 490 years. According to the prophecy of Leviticus, God will leave them in captivity until the land has had her Sabbaths, and thus the 490 years of a kingdom would come out to 70 years of Sabbaths that the land had coming. And it is interesting that that's just how long they were in captivity. But realizing the 70 years were over, Cyrus, the king of Persia, in order that the word of the Lord by Jeremiah, the mouth of Jeremiah, might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, and he made this proclamation. Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord God of heaven hath given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. And who is there among you of all of his people, his God be with him, let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of Jehovah God of Israel, for he is God. Now it is here the grammatic text, they tried to indicate it in the parentheses there, the brackets. He is the Lord God of Israel, which is in Jerusalem. He is the God, is the idea. It isn't that he is a localized God. It isn't the sense of his being a local deity, which was a popular concept in those days. And whosoever remaineth in any place where he sojourneth, let the men of his place help him with silver, with gold, with goods, and with animals, beside the freewill offerings for the house of God that is in Jerusalem. So the proclamation now by Cyrus to release the people of Israel from their captivity. Turn to Isaiah chapter 44, beginning with verse 28. Back in verse 24 of chapter 44, thus saith the Lord, thy Redeemer, the one that formed thee. I am the Lord that makes all things, that stretched out the heavens, spread abroad the earth by myself. Thus saith this Lord of Cyrus, verse 28. He is my shepherd, and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple thy foundation shall be laid. You say, well, so what? Well, this happens to be 170 years before, 180 years actually, before the decree went forth. It happened to be 150 years or so before Cyrus was born that the prophet Isaiah, through the word of the Lord, calls the guy by name. Now explain that one. One of the greatest apologetics that the Bible is indeed the Word of God is the internal evidences of inspiration, and this is one of them, where the Lord, through the prophets, spoke of events of the future with interesting details, and in this case, even naming individuals, naming Cyrus, and then bragging about the fact that I have named you and you don't even know me. Verse 4 of 45, chapter 45, "For Israel, mine elect, I have called thee by thy name. I have surnamed thee, though you have not known me." So God is talking about the guy before he's ever born, saying, look, I named you. I am the one that gave you your name. God knows a lot more about you than you imagine that he does. You are of interest to God. Jesus spoke about how that there is not a sparrow that falls to the ground, but what your Father is not aware of it. Now, if your Father is aware of sparrows, how much more is he aware of you, his child? And so here in chapter 45, "Thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus." He calls him his shepherd. Now he calls him his anointed. "Whose right hand I have held to subdue the nations before him." I have been his strength. I'm the one that helped him to subdue the nations. "I will loose the loins of kings." As you read the book of Daniel, at the time of the fall of Babylon, the night that Babylon fell and Belshazzar was having that great party and brawl, drunken brawl in the palace, and ordered the vessels that his grandfather Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem to be brought into this banqueting house that they might drink their wine out of the sanctified vessels of the temple. And as they were drinking the wine and praising the gods of gold and silver, suddenly there came over on the wall a hand that was writing on the plaster words that he did not understand. But he was terrified, and the Bible says the joints of his loins were loosed and his knees smote one against another. His knees began to shake. He was so terrified. But notice, the joints of his loins were loose. God said concerning Cyrus, "I will loose the loins of kings." Fulfilled. 170 years later. The Lord also said, "I will open before him the two levied gates." Within the city of Babylon, the river Euphrates dissected the river, the city of Babylon. And of course, the Persian troops diverted the flow of the Euphrates so that those that were besieging the city, when the water of the river receded, they were able to come in on the river bank inside the city, these huge walls, humongous walls, 300 feet high, 87 feet across the top. They were able to come in under these walls on the banks of the River Euphrates. However, within the city of Babylon, there were also walls lining the River Euphrates that had these large gates that would be shut at night and locked. But according to the historian Herodotus, this particular night that Cyrus made his invasion, those gates were left open. As the Lord said 170 years earlier, I will open to you the two levee gates. Those were the gates in the center of the city that led directly into the palace. The gates shall not be shut. Isaiah could not know that except by divine inspiration. And God goes on to say, I will go before you. I will make the crooked places straight. I will break in pieces the gates of brass. I'll cut in sunder the bars of iron. And I will give thee the treasures of darkness, the hidden riches of the secret places. And of course, when Persia conquered Babylon, they conquered the treasure store, the wealth of the world. But the purpose, that you may know that I, the Lord, which call thee by thy name, am the God of Israel. I'll do these things that you may know that I am the Lord, the God of Israel. So coming back now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, Babylon has been conquered. In order that the word of the Lord might be fulfilled, these prophecies, he's made this decree to allow the people of Israel to return, that they might build the house. And he realizes, I've been commissioned by God. He has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. God's given me this commandment, this charge. Now, there is a lot of talk today about the 10 lost tribes of Israel. You've heard that term, I'm sure. The northern kingdom comprised of the 10 northern tribes, taken captives by the Assyrians. And there are those that would try to trace their wanderings or they're being repopulated on into Europe, on into England, so that they seek to identify the Anglo-Saxons as actually the 10, what they call, lost tribes of Israel. And they use such logic as the Danes, who are known as Danish, or the Danish people. Dan, D-A-N, ish. The word ish in Hebrew is man. So Danish, they are Dan's men, or they are from the tribe of Dan. And thus they try to identify some of the various Anglo-Saxon peoples as to their tribes. Of course, you have Swedish, and I don't know of what tribe Swed would have been from. English, but they say, well, you see, it has the ish on the end. Well, so does fool. And that's what it is, foolish. This decree made by Cyrus extended to all of Israel, not just the southern kingdom of Judah. If you will turn to chapter 2, verse 70, It says, so the priests and the Levites and some of the people and the singers and the porters and the Nethinims dwelt in their cities, and all Israel in their cities. So this repatriation was not just of Judah. But when Persia conquered the Babylonian Empire, the Babylonian Empire had already conquered the Assyrian Empire. And so Persia, as Cyrus said, I rule all the kingdoms of the world. And so his decree was not limited to just Judah, but it was a decree that extended to all of Israel. So that those who returned from the captivity were people from all of the tribes of Israel. And I was starting to say 12 tribes, but you know better than that. You know there are 13. And Levi was usually not counted as a tribe. And the tribe of Joseph was divided into two, Ephraim and Manasseh. So there were 12 sons of Jacob. The one son, Joseph, became two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh, the double portion to Joseph, and thus made 13 tribes. But whenever they are listed, they are never listed as 13 tribes. They're always listed as the 12 tribes, and you'll always find that there's one missing whenever you read the list. Or the tribes in Ephraim and Manasseh are combined together into the tribe of Joseph. But in the listings, there's always a listing of 12. 12 is the number of human governmental perfection. And so the 12 apostles, the 12 tribes, and it is a biblically a significant number of government, human government. And thus, the tribes are all included at this point of history. So there are not 10 lost tribes that migrated to England, and of course they have fanciful stories of Jeremiah taking one of the descendants of David and taking him into Egypt and then on to England, where he became the monarch in England, and England is the only nation that still has a monarchy, you know, that goes way back, and God promised to David there should never cease one of his seed to be sitting upon the throne, and thus the king of England is a part of the seed of David, etc., etc., ad nauseum. So the decree went forth, verse 5. Then rose up the chief of the fathers of Judah and Benjamin, and the priest, and the Levites, all of them whose spirit God had raised up to go and build the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem. And all they were about them strengthened their hands. Those that were about them, the people, their friends, their relatives, strengthened their hands. And they gave them vessels of silver with gold and goods. They gave them the beast and the precious things beside all that they willingly offered. And Cyrus the king brought forth the vessels that had been taken from the house of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had brought forth out of Jerusalem, and to put them in the house of Merodach his god. And even those did Cyrus the king of Persia bring forth by the hand of Mithridath the treasurer, and he numbered them unto Sheshbazzar the prince of Judah. And this is the number of them. There were 30 chargers of gold, 1,000 chargers of silver, and 29 knives, 30 basins of gold, silver basins of a second sort, 410, and other vessels, 1,000. And all of the vessels of gold and silver were 5,400. And all of these did Sheshbazzar bring up with them of the captivity, and he brought them from Babylon to Jerusalem. So this group now begins to gather together the treasures, the wealth to go back to begin to rebuild the temple that is in Jerusalem. Now these are the children of the province, verse chapter 2, that went up out of captivity of those which had been carried away, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away unto Babylon. And they came again unto Jerusalem and Judah, every one unto his city. And first of all, in verse 2 and 3, we have a list, or in verse 2, we have a listing of the leaders. And notice the first two leaders, Zerubbabel. He was one of the sort of head men, and Joshua was the high priest, the chief priest. You will read again of Zerubbabel in Nehemiah, and then if you would, for your own benefit, for extra credit, read Zechariah this week. You'll find that Joshua and Zerubbabel figure very, they have a very important place in the prophecy of Zechariah. The prophet Zechariah was writing at this time. Also read Haggai. That's easy. Only a couple of chapters in Haggai. Read Haggai and read Zechariah. And knowing what's going on here will give you an understanding, a better understanding of these prophets, if you would read them in conjunction with Ezra and Nehemiah. In verses 3 to verse 19, you have the naming of the various family heads. These are the various families that came back and the numbers from that particular family. Beginning with verse 20 to verse 35, you have the listings of the cities. The people from these various cities that returned, the numbers of people and the cities where they lived, the families came from these various cities. Verse 36 to 39, you have a listing of the priest. And then beginning with verse 40, the listing of the Levites. And that goes to verse 54, and beginning with verse 55, you have the servants of Solomon, the children of Solomon's servants, and the names of the servants of Solomon and their children. And then again in verse 61, you have the children of the priests. And the various families of the priests that came back. Now in verse 62 you have something interesting. This last grouping in verse 61, they sought through the genealogies to find their pedigree of sorts. But they could not, and they did not have sufficient proof. The family Bible had been lost, and they didn't have, you know, the names of their parents. They didn't have a good genealogy. And so their search was made, and their names were not found. They could not prove that they were of the priesthood. Therefore, they were considered as unclean, not able to serve in the priesthood. And the Tirshatha, who was Zerubbabel, said unto them that they should not eat of the most holy things until there stood up a priest with the Urim and the Thummim. Back when God first established the priesthood under the law of Moses, A part of the priest vestment was the Urim and the Thummim, of which we know very little. The words in Hebrew mean lights and perfections. All we know is that somehow they used the Urim and the Thummim to determine the will of God. The Urim and the Thummim were worn by the priest as a part of his vestments, and through these they would inquire of the will of the Lord. There have been various suggestions offered as to what the Urim and the Thummim were, but we really don't know. All they are is suggestions and conjecture. The Bible doesn't really tell us. But leave it to Joe Smith to tell you what the Bible doesn't tell you. For he tells us that the Urim and the Thummim, that the Urim and the Thummim were a pair of glasses that he discovered with the golden tablets. And they were magic glasses, because when he put these glasses on that he found with the golden tablets, the glasses which were the Urim and the Thummim, he could then read the hieroglyphics of these golden tablets. So that's Joe's interpretation. I don't put much stock in it. But they were divining instruments by which they would determine the will of the Lord. And throughout the Old Testament period, up until this period, through the years, they would go to the priest to inquire of the Lord, up until about the period of the prophets, and then they would go to the prophet to inquire the will of the Lord. But up through and until the period of the prophets, the priest was... David went often to the priest to inquire from the Urim and the Thummim concerning what they should do, whether or not they should go into battle, when they should go into battle, what would the results be, and so forth. And God spoke to them. It was a divining instrument of some kind. Now, Zerubbabel, when these fellows say they are of the priesthood, because they could not produce genealogies that proved it, they were not allowed to enter into the priesthood until he said, you know, we've established the whole thing. We have a high priest with the Urim and the Thummim in which we might inquire from the Lord to find out if these men are true or not. There is no record or indication that the priesthood ever again did use the Urim and the Thummim for the discerning of the will of God. It would seem from the silence that it never did develop again as a method or means of discerning God's will. I think it's quite interesting that in the New Testament, when the disciples sought to discern God's will concerning the choice of one to take the place of Judas Iscariot to bring their number back up to 12, and they chose Matthias and Barsabbas, and then in order to discern God's will between these two fellows, they cast lots, or sort of drew straws. That's an interesting way of finding God's will, is drawing straws. I think, though, that they made a real mistake. And I think that often we do make a mistake when we limit God to just two choices. God, which of the two shall it be? Well, it turned out it wasn't either of the two. And we often make a mistake when we say, well, God, shall I do this or that? Come on, let's be fair. Let's leave it totally open. God, what do you want me to do? It's often we limit it to two. We say, well, I've got this or that. But God has alternatives that we haven't even thought about. And it's important that we leave it totally open to the Lord. Lord, just guide me. And, of course, the Lord later chose Paul as an apostle by the will of God. These fellows were not allowed actively in the priesthood because of their inability to produce their genealogy. So the whole congregation who returned was 42,660 plus their servants. And according to a apocryphal book of Esdras, they did not number the children under the age of 12. So there was possibly as many as 60,000 or so that returned because they did. And, of course, there were the servants with their maids who were 7,337. And among them, they had 200 singing men and singing women, the choirs. Now, he even gives you the number of their horses, if you're interested. 736, 245 mules. Now, if you divide that into the number of people, that means they didn't really have that many horses, that many mules. Camels, 435, means about every hundredth man had a camel. Donkeys, of course, which were the main burden of beast of burden, they had 6,720. And some of the chief fathers, when they came to the house of the Lord, which was at Jerusalem, offered freely for the house of God to set it up in its place. In other words, as they came back. Can you imagine, though, here is this small group of people, relatively speaking, from those that went into captivity. The Jews, basically, prior to captivity, were agrarian. They were farmers. Each man had his plot of land and grew his own food. When they were taken as captives to Babylon, Babylon was the commercial center. And so the Jews became businessmen. And they were such excellent businessmen that many of them didn't want to go back to the farm. And thus, they had become so prosperous and so successful in their business ventures that they really weren't concerned to going back to the hardship of trying to rebuild the land. And thus, many of them just remained in Babylon, in Persia and all, rather than to go back to the hardships of rebuilding. But those that came back, as they made their final way up to Jerusalem, as they came over the top of the Mount of Olives, and they looked down upon the rubble of that once glorious city, can you imagine the mixed emotions that they must have felt? Excitement, we're back, but yet, oh, what desolation, what rubble. And so there was that mixed emotions in the people in this returning. They gave, according to their ability, unto the treasure of the work, 61,000 drams of gold, 5,000 pounds of silver, or 5,000 pound of silver, it isn't equal to our pound, and 100 priest garments. So the priests and the Levites and some of the people and the singers and the porters and the Nethinims dwelt in their cities and all of Israel in their cities. They didn't all come back to Jerusalem. A segment did. But you notice in verses 3 to 19, there are many cities and people that went back to their own cities. Now, when the seventh month was come, this is the month of religious celebration. This is the month in which they had Yom Kippur, the month in which they celebrated the Feast of the Tabernacles. The children of Israel were in the cities, and the people gathered themselves, according to the law, to Jerusalem as one man, as keeping the law, gathering to worship. And then Joshua, the son of Josadak, and his brothers the priest, and Zerubbabel, these two guys, you're going to mark their names and put their card file in because you're going to come across them again. And Shealtiel and his brethren, they built the altar of God of Israel to offer the burnt offerings thereon, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. And they set the altar upon the bases. The original foundation stones were still there. So on these foundation stones, they built a new altar in order that they might offer sacrifices thereon. For fear was upon them because of the people of those countries, and they offered burnt offerings thereon unto the Lord, even burnt offerings morning and evening. So they began the morning and the evening sacrifices. The people that had moved into the land during this 70-year period were hostile to them when they returned. And they were actually outnumbered by these people, and these people began to seek to hinder their work, as we will find out as we move along in Ezra. They also kept the Feast of the Tabernacles, as it is written. And they offered the daily burnt offerings by number, according to the custom, as the duty of every day required. And afterward, they offered the continual burnt offering, both of the new moons, all of the set feasts of the Lord that were consecrated, and everyone that willingly offered a freewill offering unto the Lord. So the various offerings, the daily sacrifices, the special sacrifices on the new moon, as was required in the law of Moses, plus daily the freewill offerings as people brought in their sacrifices on a freewill offering basis to the Lord. And from the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings unto the Lord. But the foundations of the temple were not yet laid. They just set up the altar so that they could offer the sacrifices there in the court of the temple, and they had not yet begun the rebuilding of the temple. Now they gave money also to the masons, to the carpenters. They gave them their food and drink and oil. And they sent to Sidon and to Tyre, giving them, of course, Sidon and Tyre are coastal areas. There isn't much area for growing food. They were more merchants, and they lived from, they were the Phoenicians, and they were navy men, and they were commercial men. But you have to have food. And so most of their food came from the land of Israel. And so it was a barter kind of a thing. We'll give you oil and grain and food, and in turn we want cedars to be sent down from Lebanon. To the Sea of Joppa, they would make these cedar rafts and float them down the Mediterranean to Joppa, and then from Joppa they'd carry them overland 35 miles to Jerusalem. No small task. According to the grant that they had from Cyrus, the king of Persia, this decree that he had in ordering the people to help them. Now in the second year of their coming unto the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month, Zerubbabel began, and Joshua and the remnant of their brothers, the priests and Levites, and all they that were come out of captivity to Jerusalem, appointed Levites from 23 years old and upward. They began the rebuilding of the temple, second year, second month. Then Joshua stood with his sons and his brethren, Kadmiel and his sons, the sons of Judah, together. And they set forward the workmen in the house of God, the sons of Henadad with their sons and the brethren, the Levites. And when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of Jehovah, they set the priest in their apparel with trumpets. The Levites, it's a big groundbreaking ceremony, you know, and we're going to start the building now. So the priests were there with their in their apparel, in their robes. They had their trumpets. The Levites, the sons of Asaph, with their cymbals to praise the Lord after the ordinance of David the king. And they sang together by chorus, that is antiphonal, in praising and in giving of thanks. So many of the psalms are called antiphonal psalms in that the ladies would sing one part, like, "Oh, give thanks unto the Lord." The men would respond, "For he is good, for his mercy endureth forever." And so many of them have that response, the ladies singing out, "The fear of the Lord is clean," the men responding, "enduring forever." "The judgments of the Lord are true," the men would respond, "and righteous altogether." And it was a back and forth kind of thing, no doubt very beautiful, as they would worship the Lord. And this is one where the women would sing in giving of thanks, "Oh, give thanks unto the Lord." The men would respond, "Because he is good, for his mercy endureth forever toward Israel." And all of the people began to shout with a great shout. It was an exciting time. Finally, we're beginning the rebuilding of the temple of the Lord. People were shouting when they praised the Lord because the foundation of the house of the Lord was being laid. Exciting time. Time of praising God and shouting. But there were also many of the priests and the Levites and the chief of the fathers who were old men. They could still remember the Temple of Solomon when they were children and taken from Jerusalem. They remember the glory and all of the Temple of Solomon. And when the foundation of this house was being laid, they wept with a loud voice. And many shouted aloud for joy. So there was this mixed emotion, the old men weeping. You know, it's such a pitiful thing in comparison to the glory and the splendor of Solomon's temple. The young guys, "Hey, this is great, you know. All right, we're doing it. Let's, you know." And theirs was the shout of joy, where the old men weeping. So that the people could not discern the noise, couldn't tell between those that were shouting from joy and those that were weeping, the noise of the weeping of the people. And they would wail when they would weep. I mean, they would really wail. In fact, you've heard of the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem. You go today and you watch the bar mitzvahs and you hear the interesting type of wailing that sometimes goes on, which is not a weeping. But in those days, they had professional wailers, people who had extremely good lungs. And they would be hired for funerals. It was a cultural thing to indicate how sorrowful you were at the death of a loved one. You really love them, and you're very sorry that they're dead. You want to show how sorry you are. You'd hire these professional wailers. They come in and really wail so the whole city would know that something horrible has happened, as they'd hear all of these wailers, you know. And if you could really wail, you could get a pretty good price for your services. So the people could not discern the noise of the shout for joy or the noise of the weeping, but the people shouted with a loud shout, and the noise was heard afar off. They were all shouting, it's interesting, the acoustics in that land, you can hear for miles and from afar off. And it did create some problems. The people heard all of the noise and they came to see what it was all about. And in next chapter, we'll find some of the problems that arose because of this. So next week, we'll continue the book of Ezra as we look at chapters 4 and 5. May the Lord give you a great week, watching over you, filling you with his love, guiding you according to his plan. May you experience the work of the Spirit within your heart, deepening your commitment unto Jesus Christ, causing you to have a true perspective of life, helping you to discern between that which is temporal and that which is eternal, in order that you might give yourself over to the things that really count. And thus may God's hand be upon you to guide and to keep and to make it a blessed week for you as you commit yourself to following Jesus Christ.